Good to be here this morning. We're going to be looking at the Bible. Probably not a big surprise, but we're actually going to look at the Bible today. We're not just looking at a particular passage, but we're going to ask some questions about what is this book? What is in this book? How do we read this book? How can we understand what's in this book better? How can this book help us fall more in love with Jesus? And we've got a very short time to do it. The good news is I've done a talk like this before. The bad news is it took about an hour and a half. So I hope you all brought your packed lunch with you, and I'm sure the kids will be well cared for, and it's all good. We're going to go from Genesis to Revelation along with some comments. And we're going to do it in about 35 minutes. We ready? Why are we doing this? Do you know what? The Bible is an incredible gift to us. An incredible gift to us. We need to keep it in its right perspective. We need to hold on to it properly. But without the Scriptures, it's very, very difficult for us to know Jesus at all. At all. And I was reading yesterday, that 52 countries of the world have banned the Bible. That's a lot. There are brothers and sisters all over the world that will die for having a Bible. I want to be clear, none of them die for the Bible, they die for Jesus. But the act of having a Bible is such that it can cost them their lives. And how many of us bring our Bibles out on Sundays and then put it back on its nice shelf or on the desk and then get it out again next Sunday? And I think there's loads of reasons for that, right? Because if you leave here today feeling bad about what I've said, like, oh no, I'm running rubbish, I don't read my Bible enough, then I've missed the point. I want us to be excited today about what's in here. But there are reasons, I think, that we end up not reading the Scriptures as well. One is Martin's fault. He preaches too well. And I mean that seriously. Martin preaches to us so well that two things happen. One, we feel like we're fed, which is a good thing. But the other is, Martin preaches so well that oftentimes he'll do things with the Scriptures and we go, man, I couldn't do that. And actually, rather than inspiring us to read the Bible more, we end up going, well, I can't do that, so it's not really worthwhile, is it? I tell you, that's rubbish. And Martin would say, that's rubbish. And so what we should be seeing is Martin's great preaching, opening the Scriptures up to us, and then us going away and taking that and saying, okay, maybe I can't do that, but I can do something with this, right? And hopefully today we'll get one or two tools that help us to get the most out of it. So that's one reason. It's a rubbish reason, okay? We understand that's a rubbish reason for not reading our Bibles, but it is one. And the other is, we're too busy, right? Who feels like they're too busy to read the Bible as often as they would like? The honesty time, confession is good for the soul, come on. If everybody doesn't put their hands up, I'm just going to start yelling liar from the front, okay? Henri Nouwen talked about discipline, and he said this. He said that discipline is the effort to create some space in which God can act. So actually, sometimes I think we think that discipline is reading the Bible. No, actually, the discipline is creating the space in which God can act. We diarize everything in our lives these days. We walk around with our phone. Somebody says, can you have coffee next week? Let me ask my phone. You know, what are our kids doing? I don't know. Let me ask my phone. How many of you have read the Bible in your phone? Probably not many of us. Some of you do. Good. We need to learn from these people. That's good. Simple things. Use technology to help us to create that space. But I also want to be filled with grace and recognize there are seasons in our life. I think particularly women who have had new babies, the idea that you're going to get up at a really normal time every day and have that space that's completely carved out and the child won't cry, need fed, need its nappy changed, or anything for that time is just not true. And you need grace for that, right? C- Because what this is not is just a whole load of laws that are meant to make us feel bad, and if you don't read it, then you've got it wrong, and Jesus is really unhappy with you. Supposed to read this to life and to Jesus, who is love. So, those are two reasons that we don't do it. We need to work at that and have grace in that. But why should we read it? Well, because it points us to Jesus, and Jesus gives us life and hope and joy. I'm not going to argue today about the infallibility of Scripture or about the veracity of what we have. We could do that. There's lots of stuff we could say about that. But I'm going to take it as read that we're going to treat the Bible as the Bible. It is infallible, and what's in there is true. If you have a problem with that, come and chat with me later, and we can sit for hours. I will bore you for hours about the truth of that stuff. But I also want to say this is not an academic exercise. This is not about me trying to fill your heads with more information so that you can read the words on a page better. Okay? It's an act of devotion, and devotion is a relational term, not a legal term. We seek a relationship with Jesus, not an understanding of the words on the page. Reading our Bibles is not one of legalism, not an act of legalism, but one of devotion. We find the words of Jesus. As my preaching professor used to say, we come to these holy scriptures not to understand them, but to stand under them, and they shape us. We should have a little presentation thing coming up here. Let's see. Can we go to our next slide and the one after that? There we go. Almost impossible to read. Perfect. Good. Quick overview. What is in the Bible? Well, it's one book. One book. And yet it's 66 books. But it's not a simple anthology, right? It's not 66 random books that have been stuck together. Actually, there is a cohesiveness to these books that have been put together. They were put together under the supervision of God. The books, there are loads and loads of other books that could have been part of this. Paul wrote more. We know that Paul wrote a lot more letters than the ones that we find in here. We know that the Hebrews have used other scriptures or other letters and writings to help them in their spiritual way, but they're not considered to be part of the Bible. Why is that? Well, because over time, the Holy Spirit has inspired the church to say these are the scriptures that we're going to have. The Old Testament, we simply took the Jewish Old Testament canon and said that is our scriptures. And then the New Testament was formed over a period of time, over a few hundred years after Jesus' life. And certainly by the 3rd or 4th century, we have a really settled sense of these are the books that are part of the New Testament that the church has said this is what God has given us. So it is 66 books, but we must remember it is one book, that there is a cohesiveness. There is no book in here that somehow randomly outlies all the others and says stuff that doesn't fit with all the rest. There are books that we don't read very often, because really Lamentations isn't that exciting, right? And which of us really knows what to do with Song of Songs and things like that? But there is one story being told. There is one point to this book. And yes, it appears in 66 books. The important thing is to remember, though, the 66 books are written in very different ways. So Song of Songs and Lamentations need read in very different ways, or we're going to end up with very funny conclusions. The book of Revelation is quite clearly nothing like the book of Romans. They're written in very different ways. They're written in particular literary styles. We need to be honest about that so that we can read them better. We don't read them the same. If I gave you a book of poetry and then gave you a book about history, you wouldn't read them the same, right? The history book presumably is telling me stuff that happened, and I'm going to read about that, and I'm going to learn about the people that were involved in that history. If I give you a poetry book, you're going to be looking for allusions to things. You're going to be looking for what's it hinting at here? What does this picture that's being painted? It'll be a much more creative exercise, perhaps, than reading. We need to do the same with the scriptures, because that's how they are written. One book, 66 books. One book, 40 authors. There are about 40 authors. We're not altogether sure, but about 40 authors. And they were probably all men, but maybe not. So that's another conversation for another day. But anyway, it's a divine and a human work. This is a really important point. Why does it matter that there are 40 authors? Well, because God has overseen, God has inspired these people to write down what is written. But let's understand what that isn't, okay? God did not, for example, say to the angel Gabriel, here are the words I want you to give. The angel Gabriel then comes down and sits down with somebody and says, write this. And they wrote this. And that provides a book. That apparently happened, and that book that was provided, do you know what that is? That's a Quran. That's how Muslims understand the Quran was written. God dictated it to Gabriel. Gabriel came and told Muhammad. Muhammad wrote it down. That is the Quran. That's how they understand it was put together. We don't believe that because, you see, Muhammad had no part in writing the Quran. We believe that Paul and Peter and Moses and Isaiah and all the authors of the scriptures, actually their character comes through because God used these men and people, we'll just go with men, generic, used these men to, in their character, in their understanding of their language, in their understanding of their culture, to write down the perfect infallible scriptures. So there's a divine and a human element going on here. Why is that important? Because when we read it, we need to realize that. So when we come, and we will have a quick look at this, very quick look at this, when we come to the Gospels, we see the Gospels are written by four different people, and they have a different flavor to each of them. And it's important that we realize that that's okay. We don't need to justify that. It's actually part of the point of the way the scriptures have been put together. One author and yet 40 authors. One message in three languages. The Bible's written in three languages. Most people know this, but we'll just be clear. Hebrew, which is what the majority of the Old Testament was written in. Some of the Old Testament is also written in Aramaic, and then the New Testament is written predominantly in Greek with one or two little Aramaic words thrown in here and there just for fun. Why does that matter? Well, it doesn't, other than it means that the Bible most certainly wasn't written in English, just for the avoidance of all doubt. That means that it's been translated from these original languages into English, which means that we get lots of different translations. So many of you will have an English Standard Version, or if you're sitting with your little gadget thing and you're not playing Angry Birds, you're actually listening and reading the scriptures, then you'll have probably 30 or 40 different choices of English language. For some people, that's a problem. Like, why do all these exist? Well, really simply, they exist because of two things. One is it depends what type of Greek or Hebrew text they're translating from. So for the most part, all the modern translations use the same Greek text and the same Hebrew text to translate from. The King James Bible would be an exception to that. They use a thing called the Textus Receptus, which is really old. Some of you are now switching off. You're like, oh, my word. But they use a much older translation, Greek text, which we've subsequently found lots more Greek texts since that one, and we know now probably a more accurate Greek text. So it's getting very complicated. We'll move on quickly. I can see some people glazing over. The point is this. We can have confidence in what we have in English. The way that they're translated, the ESV takes a much more word-for-word translation. The NIV that I use, it takes what's called dynamic equivalence. They look at the sentence rather than the individual word, and they say, these are the main words of that sentence. How do we make that the sense of that sentence make sense to the English hearer as it would have made sense to a first century Jew or Gentile? Does that make sense? So that's why we end up with different translations. The one other thing on this issue of language that can be helpful, why is it sometimes when we have a quotation in the New Testament of the Old Testament, so when Paul or Jesus or somebody quotes from the Old Testament, and then we go and look it up in the Old Testament, it's not quite the same. Have you ever done that? And you go, oh, what's going on there? Well, the reason is that that around the time of the first century, most of the people were using what's called the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament. So we don't use that. We use the Hebrew translation of the Old Testament, that was what's called the Masoretic text, which means that we end up with a slight difference between what they say. Simple translational issues. Same reason the NIV says something slightly different from the ESV. Does that make sense? Yeah. For two of you. Okay, we'll move on. We'll move on. One story, two chapters. You know this. There's an Old Testament and a New Testament. You don't get to pick one over the other. Really, really important for Christians that we don't think the New Testament, that's the one that tells us about who God really is, and the Old Testament, well, that's something other entirely going on over there, and it's kind of helpful. And throughout church history, we've had heresy after heresy after heresy that has come out of that one simple mistake. Particularly, there's a guy called Marcion who just basically wanted to bin the Old Testament and said, that the Old Testament, that God back there, he was a kind of evil God, and the good God is revealed in the New Testament. That's rubbish. If you read the Bible like that, it's a mistake, because there is only one story being told through these two chapters. What is that story then? Let's get to the good bit. Here we go. The Old Testament is laid out in four sections: the law, or sometimes referred to as the Torah, or the Pentateuch, Pentateuch bound for five. These were traditionally known as being written by Moses, and we accept that, except that Deuteronomy records Moses' death. So that would be a little problematic for him to have written that, but for the most part, Moses wrote all of the law. Can we move on to the next slide? Thanks. So that was the law. So that's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. That's the Torah, the law. The next section is what's referred to as the writings or poetry. And in there we have Job and Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Song of Songs. Next one, please. Should be history. So we see all the history stories. So 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Joshua, Judges, Ruth. All the ones that tell the story of Israel are classified in there. And then finally we'll have the prophets separated into major and minor. And those four sections make up what are the Hebrew scriptures. And the Hebrews would think of them in those sections. And again, it goes back to how do we read those? Each of those sections we're going to want to read slightly differently and think about slightly differently. But they're all entirely scriptural. We treat them all the same. They're all accorded the same authority as one to the other. Next slide, please. This one, oh, rubbish. That's a bit depressing. The next one will hopefully be better. This makes perfect sense to you all. That's the story of the Old Testament. Right, we're done? Good. I do actually have handouts. Nice. So you can pick these up at the end that will actually show you what is on there. Can we go to the next slide? Yes. Boom. Right, this is the first part of that. I'm going to walk you through everything the Old Testament says in 5 minutes. Oh, my wife has no faith. Jesus, we need your help right now. Okay, why am I doing this? I could have said anything about the Bible today. Loads and loads of stuff. We could have been here for weeks. I think if we grasp the narrative of the Old Testament in particular, it really helps us to put into place what's going on when we read all the other bits. Does that make sense? So I'm going to gallop us through the whole of the story of the Old Testament in 5 minutes. I'm going to time myself. Here we go. Let's go. So it begins with this universal history. And that is really Genesis chapters 1 through 11, where we see good creation. Really important we begin there. Creation was good. Okay, that's the beginning of our story. God made, and the creation was good. We then move on, and we see the fall happens, and there's a break there, and so suddenly everything that was good is now broken, and we've got a real problem on our hands. And then we see how that begins to play out through Cain and Abel. We see Noah and the judgment that comes there, and we see Babel, and again, judgment there. But in both cases there is judgment, there is also grace, and already there's a hint at the story and how it's all going to begin to unfold. Then we move into this season of the patriarchs, which begins with Genesis chapter 12. I think Genesis 12 might be the most important passage in the whole of the scriptures. Might be. Lots of other people would disagree with me. What's in there? It's the promise to Abraham, the promise of people that he would be a great people, the promise that they would have a land, and the promise that they would be blessed and be a blessing. Okay? And it's a completely unconditional promise. Completely unconditional promise. It doesn't mean that Abraham has to do something in order to get that. We're going to see covenants that come later that do require both obedience on the part of God's people, and God will then act. But in the context of Genesis 12, this is the gospel. This is God beginning to restore something that was broken. And so the promise comes, and Abraham needs a miracle because he's an old man and his wife is an old woman, and he's been told he will have a great people. Well, that's a problem because they don't have any kids, and so God's going to need to come through, and that's where it begins to start, this amazing gospel. It needs a miracle to begin. And the people growth is integral to that gospel. Him having children, his family then marrying and having more children becomes integral to the gospel. And so God commits to that family in a remarkable way, because actually it is about the promise of God coming to fulfillment requires them to have children and such like. And it happens. The whole of the book of Genesis is the unraveling of that. The patriarchs come along and we see what will become the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. And at the end of the book of Genesis, we see that they are beginning to grow as a people, but they're in Egypt. They're not in any land at all. Then along comes Moses, a baby who's smuggled out of a place where lots of babies are being killed. Remember that fact? It will come back helpful, useful later. Moses is raised up in particular to lead the people out of Egypt. What's going to happen there? Well, he begins to set up this situation where we see Passover and substitution become a really important theme in this story. And so this people that's grown up into a massive multitude since the end of the book of Genesis, God is going to lead them out of Exodus by using Moses. Lead them in Exodus, out of Egypt. He takes them through a great victory over an enemy. And what happens is they come along, they pass through the water, remember that again, and they go into the wilderness. And they're going to wander in the wilderness. But in the wilderness, two amazing things happen. One is that the law is revealed to them. So this is another covenant. But this one requires obedience on the part of the people of God. But they have the law, and the tabernacle is set up. And I was reading this week, a guy called Vaughan Roberts, and he said that this is the absolute climax of the Exodus. Not the law, but the tabernacle. God has come to dwell among his people. And so he dwells in the midst of the people. And so they are now God's people. They're not in the land, but they are certainly experiencing some of God's blessing. But they can't enter the land because of their disobedience. And so they all die off, including Moses, and then God raises up Joshua. Along comes Joshua. Joshua leads the people through the water. Here we go again, through the water and into the land. Then comes what I think are the most difficult passages in the whole of the Old Testament. I don't really know what to do with them. We see the conquest narratives where all the people who are there are wiped out, and we could spend ages. If you're interested in that, if it causes you a problem, I'd recommend to you a book called Fight by a guy called Preston Sprinkle, who some of you may... Did he come here? Yeah, he used to come here. It's a very, very good book about nonviolence. It's really helpful, but he's got a big section on what to do with the conquest narratives if they cause you a problem like they do me. Anyway, the conquest comes along, and the people are pushed out of the land, and Israel eventually takes over the land. And then we see this new setup, and along come the judges. And basically, the book of Judges can be summed up really quickly. But what happens is that everything is a mess, and the people cry out to God. God has mercy and raises up a judge. Peace and order is restored to Israel, and then the people rebel and judgment comes. And then the people cry out to God because everything's a mess and God has mercy and raises up a judge. And that's the cycle of the book of Judges. And it gets to the end and it's all in a great big mess. And Samuel is the last judge. And the people have come to Samuel and say, "We want a king." And so God eventually relents and says, "You can have a king." See, they weren't supposed to have a king because God was supposed to be the king, but we don't really have time to go into that today. So they get a king. They want, because they want to be like all the other nations. First of all, they get Saul. Saul begins well, but then falls away. In the midst of that, David is anointed to be the next king. He's a man after God's own heart. And I love this. He wants to build the temple. He really desires to build the temple. David has this great big palace, and he looks around, and he says, "I've got this great big palace. I want to build an amazing place for God." And God says, "No, you're a man of war. You're not getting to build the temple." But God gives David this incredible promise. In 2 Samuel 7, he says that your throne will be established forever. And there's this wonderful, wonderful promise to David that becomes important in a second. Anyway, David dies. Solomon, his son, takes over. He establishes a real sense of peace around Israel. It works reasonably well to begin with. And he gets to build the temple. But then he goes a bit pear-shaped. He starts bringing foreign wives in. That's not necessarily the problem. There isn't the sexual element of that he ends up with so many wives, though that is a problem. But the big problem is they are foreign wives. And so he's bringing idolatry into the house of God, and that is a huge problem. And so things begin to spiral out of control And then once Solomon dies, the kingdom is divided. It's split in two. It's a really important narrative point in how we read the whole of the Old Testament. So it's split in two. The northern kingdom, which really confusingly remains being called Israel, and the southern kingdom, which is called Judah. Northern kingdom based in Samaria, southern kingdom based around Jerusalem. And so we have this real sense of that going on. And then the kings come along, and they're a disaster. There's pretty much none of them are any good after that. There are some, but we don't have time for that. We really don't have time for that. 7 minutes, I'm not finished yet. Come on. And then this is where the prophets appear, because the prophets start writing, particularly when we've got this divided kingdom. And basically, the prophets are really hard work to read. If you sit and read the prophets, it's hard work, because basically they're saying, you need to obey God, and if you don't obey God, all sorts of terrible stuff's going to happen to you. And then the people don't obey God, and so all sorts of terrible stuff happens to them. And basically, what the culmination of that is that the northern kingdom is called Israel, the 10 tribes up there, they're carted off. And they're carted off by the Assyrians, and we really hear nothing more about them. Done. Sometimes referred to the 10 lost tribes of Israel, a bit confusing sideline, but they're gone. The southern kingdom are taken away by the Babylonians, or the Chaldeans, if you read the book of Habakkuk, and they're carted off by them, and they go into exile. There, that's Judah. Important. That's David's line. And they're taken off into exile there. And so now God's people, no longer in God's place, barely a people, they're split in two. And they're certainly not experiencing much of God's blessing. But God looks after Judah in exile in Babylon, and that's really what we see in some of the prophets. So we see when you read Jeremiah 29, that's a letter there to them in exile, and it's saying, you know, dig down, live here, seek the peace and prosperity of this place, and you too will be blessed. It's in complete continuity with what God has said before. You're to be a blessing to the nations. And so we carry on. God raises up Ezra and Nehemiah, and the people return to Jerusalem 70 years later, though. 70 years later, don't do that, Glenn. 70 years, long time they've been away. And why is it that the south get to come back and not the north? It's because of this Davidic promise, I think, because he was told that through him, the tribe somebody would sit on the throne of God forever. And so the southern kingdom is the one that's restored. When they come back, what happens? Well, the young celebrate and the old weep. Why is that? Well, because they see this temple. This temple isn't even as big as Solomon's, and the promise of Ezekiel in exile had been that the temple would be even greater. What's going on? And then the post-exilic prophets come along, and they're very similar to the other prophets. They warn and obey that if you live in obedience, then you get to remain in the land. If you disobey, then bad things will happen. Judgment will come. And they're pointing to a future that there's more to come. And then Malachi finishes with this great promise. See, I will send the prophet Elijah to you before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the parents to the children and the hearts of the children to the parents, or else I will come and strike the land with total destruction, full stop, the end, nothing for 400 years. Silence. That's the story we have of the Old Testament. We're done. It'll make perfect sense when you see all of this. And you kept up. Good job. Can we go on to the next slide, please? We get to the New Testament. What's in the New Testament? Well, I've broken it down similarly to how the first one done. We've got the Gospels. Next slide. We've got the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and I put the book of Acts in there because it's worth thinking of Luke and Acts really as one unitary thing that's just divided two volumes of the one thing. Stay on the Gospels for a sec. Three of the Gospels are very similar, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. This is helpful for when we read them. They're referred to as the Synoptic Gospels. Most likely what happened is the Gospel of Mark was written first, and Matthew and Luke had access to the book of Mark and used that as their kind of, if you like, their framework for what they were going to write. And then they added in their own stuff. Some of that Matthew and Luke share, and then it seems each of them had access to stories of Jesus that were independent. And so that's how we build this up. And so the Synoptic Gospels are very similar but have some differences. Why is that different? Well, I want to give you faith in why they're different. If we had artists here and if we had time, I would sit one over here and one over here and one over here and say, could you paint me a picture of me preaching? Not because I'm vain, but because it seems something I may be. So the point being, say, some of them would want to capture perhaps the passion, and so they would capture me in this kind of thing. So others might want to capture me being really dull and reading from my pages, and so they'd catch me like that. Each would be true, but they're looking from a slightly different perspective and trying to tell a slightly different point. They saw the same things, heard the same things, but they're trying to make it make the point by painting it in slightly different ways. That's essentially what's going on with the Gospels, is that it seems as though they're trying to tell a slightly different point, and it's usually for different audiences. Matthew, for example, is writing to Jews, and Luke writing to Gentiles. John is quite a different bit. It seems he knew about Matthew, Mark, and Luke and wanted to write about the other stories, so he misses out an awful lot of the stuff that's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke and adds other stuff in the Gospel of John. We could be there forever. Next slide, please. The Pauline letters. So these are the letters that are traditionally attributed to the Apostle Paul. Lots of different kinds of letters in here. The book of Romans is really quite different from the book of Philemon. They're more, so there's real pastoral things there. But he does base most of his letters on what's called Greek epistolary theory. In other words, the Greeks wrote their letters in a particular way. Paul takes that way and writes his letter in that style. He twists it, but it does mean that there's a very similar structure to nearly all of Paul's letters. So if you're reading one of the big ones and getting a bit lost, lift yourself out of it and say, well, where are we at here? Because the structures are all almost always very, very similar. Next slide. We have the general letters, so Hebrews, who the only thing we know is we don't know who wrote it. James 1 and 2, Peter 1, 2, 3, and John, which probably the same as the John that wrote both the Gospel and the book of Revelation. And then Jude, these are letters that were sent to churches or to individuals. And then the last one, prophecy, we have the book of Revelation, which sits on its own and most of us ignore because we don't really know what to do with it. It's a type of writing. It's apocryphal writing. It was well known in that time. And apocalyptic. I said apocryphal, didn't I? That's a different thing altogether. We're really not going there. Apocalyptic writing, which leaves us with quite a different style that we need to wrestle with if we're going to read that and read it well. Finally, what are we going to do with the New Testament? Next slide. Yeah, this one is really difficult to read, but on the other side of your handout, you have the New Testament one. Here's what I want to say about this. All the promises of God are fulfilled in Jesus. John 5:39 says this, these are the scriptures which testify about me, Jesus is speaking. He's talking about the Old Testament there. The New Testament hasn't obviously been written at that point. I think three things come out of our reading of the Old Testament that lead us to seeing Jesus as the fulfillment of the scriptures. Jesus is the true Israel. Matthew takes time to make sure that we realize that Jesus went to Egypt as a child in exile and fled out of Egypt. Does that sound familiar? Most of the Gospels have the account of Jesus being baptized. He passed through water, and then what happens? He goes to the wilderness. Does that sound familiar to us? He was tested in the wilderness. In every way that Israel failed, so Jesus succeeded. And so Jesus becomes the true Israelite. But for Luke, that's not good enough. See, Luke is concerned with the Gentiles, and that's just not good enough. He needs more than that. So actually, Jesus, for Luke, Jesus is the true Adam. And so he traces his genealogy all the way back to Adam and says, well, in every way that Adam failed, Jesus succeeded. Why does this matter? Well, it means that when Jesus is our representative on the cross, he is the true Israelite, he is the true Adam, and he is fully able to deal with all the sins that we have made. It is important, brothers and sisters. He is also God's dwelling place. I really don't have time to open this up. John 4, where Jesus meets the woman at the well, they get into this argument about worship. So where should we worship? Should we be like the Samaritans on this mountain, or should we go to Jerusalem? There's a long history of why that was an issue back to these divided kingdoms that we heard about. The northern kingdom said we can sacrifice goats on this hill here, on this hill here, and we don't need to go to Jerusalem anymore. This is the question the woman's asking. And Jesus' answer is, we're looking for worshipers in spirit and truth. Come to me, is what Jesus is saying. It's no longer about which hill do you worship on. It's who do you worship, and it's about coming to Jesus. He is God's dwelling place. And we could say an awful lot more about that. I want to give us an example of why that story approach to the Old Testament and then how that leads into the New Testament is important. I think that might be valuable. So I'm going to finish with this, I think. So the sea in the Bible is often seen as a symbol of chaos, as often referred to as evil. And so when we see it right at the beginning, God creating the heavens and the earth, the sea is seen to be this chaotic thing on the earth. And if we go to Genesis chapter 1, I realize I've read very little scripture this morning, so I kind of apologize for that. It seems ironic to have spoken from the Bible without reading from the Bible. Anyway, we'll keep going. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Just wonderful. If you're ever struggling with, is God big enough for this? Just go back to that verse. In the beginning. Now, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Verse 6. And God said, that let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. Verse 9. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let the dry ground appear. So God is commanding the waters and suggesting what should happen. If we carry on, we get Noah in Genesis chapter 7, where the judgment comes of Noah, and it's God commanding the waters again. Then we see in Exodus chapter 17, the parting of the Red Sea. That's the one miracle I would love to have seen. It's like the world's biggest aquarium, right? That's the sea all piled up. And same thing happens again, Joshua chapter 3 in the Jordan. If we look in the Psalms, or you could look in Psalm 29, or I'll read here to us, I think, from Psalm 89, which says, you rule over the surging sea, and when it waves mount up, you still them. The point is, God is in control of the sea being a symbol of chaos, and God brings order. Then we come to a very famous story in the New Testament. And we see that Jesus is in a boat with his friends, and they're going across the water. And what happens is that a storm blows up. We know this story, right? And Jesus is in the back of the boat having a nice little snooze. This is the kind of thing that Jesus does. And the water starts to come over into the boat, and the disciples start to panic, which is a big deal, right? Because, frankly, they were fishermen. They'd been in stormy seas. This must have been a particularly rough storm. Bouncing away. And what are we going to do? What are we going to do? How do we do this? I know, let's wake up Jesus. So they go and they wake up Jesus. And Jesus gets up and he literally says, shut up! And the seas and the wind die down immediately. And it says, the disciples were more afraid of Jesus than they were of the storm. Why is that? Well, because they got into the boat with a guy they thought was a prophet. And then they realized they were in the boat with God. Because the only one in all of the scriptures who ever commands the sea to do anything is God himself. From Genesis, through the Psalms, through Exodus, through Joshua. It is God who commands the sea. Why is the story important? Because it helps us to bring life to a very Jewish story in the first century around Jesus. We understand what's going on. Now, do we need to get to all that kind of depth every time? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Sometimes we just need to open our Bibles and read. And God will do remarkable things in our heart just through reading. So over the last few weeks, I've been doing a thing called the Community Bible Experience with the Bridge. And it means reading big, big chunks of Scripture. You read the book of Luke and Acts in about 10 days. So there's a fair bit of reading. It takes about 35, 40 minutes a day. And I've read the Bible from cover to cover a few times. Once because I took a course that made me do it. That was the first time I'd managed all the way through. It's amazing what credit will force you to do. But this time I've chosen to listen to it. So I've been listening to the Bible for about half an hour a day. It's remarkable the things you begin to notice that you didn't notice when you were reading. Where if you're actually reading it, the Bible, the New Testaments they provide you to read with, go all the way across the page and they have no chapter numbers or page numbers. See, the guys that were writing this, they didn't write down chapters and numbers. They were 13th and 15th century inventions. They're pretty late. And so suddenly you're reading without the numbers in there, and it comes alive. There's life to it. And it's not about picking one verse and thinking, what can I get out of that verse? It's reading great big chunks of the scriptures and saying, what is God speaking in the midst of that? And that brings life to us, brothers and sisters, because one of the things you'll notice is that the people who are in here are just like us. In fact, most of them are worse than us. You know, Moses, he killed someone. Abraham, he tried to pimp his wife twice. Like, all sorts of bad stuff happened. David killed someone. He had an affair. Peter, he was just an ordinary bloke, but he kept doing stuff that didn't really please Jesus all that much, and yet he's the guy that gets to preach the first sermon in Pentecost. Just amazing. Like, ordinary guys, but they knew their Bible, particularly the guys in the New Testament. So, a few practical observations to begin with. That would be worrying, wouldn't it? This is not a book of quotations. Don't pick it up and read it like a book of quotations where you can just go, what should we do today? Bible bingo, here we go. The waters of the river will dry up and the riverbed will be parched and dry. Good, that means it's going to be sunny tomorrow, so get my shorts on. Oh Lord, may it be so. We don't read the Bible like that. You can read a book of quotations like that and get something for the day. That's not the way to handle the scriptures. It's not an anthology of stories, each little story sitting on its own. Read as much in big chunks as you can. Try and learn the whole of the story together. Don't tear the book in two. It really is a beginning and an end. The beginning doesn't make sense without the end. The end doesn't make sense without the beginning. Read the whole thing together. Use technology. Listen as well as read. Use the spare moments in your day when you're commuting, not if you're driving. Don't go reading while you're driving or anything like that. But if you're sitting on a bus, you've got your phone there, get the Bible on your phone, use that, read. It's good for you. It's food for your soul. And finally, read in community, locally. So find people you can read the Bible with. It's really helpful. And finally, read in community historically. Like, find old dead people who have written stuff about the Bible. Most of their stuff, if it's still in public, is still being published, is worth reading. Otherwise, they wouldn't bother publishing it. On that note, our last slide. Oh, no. This is the second last slide. I tweeted a bunch of people this week who I like and said, some of them are really pastors of huge churches. This guy pastors a church of about 7,000 people. I tweeted him and said, if you had one thing to say about the Bible, what would you say? And this is the one he said. I love this. It's just caused my soul to say. He said, what the Bible does perfectly and infallibly is to point us to Jesus. Now, Martin made the point when I was talking to him about the Bible does a whole lot more than that. It absolutely does. But you know what? If you go to the Bible with this heart, a heart of devotion to say, can you point me to Jesus? The Bible is brilliant at pointing you to Jesus. Finally, here's some books. I'll leave this slide up at the end. If you're thinking, how do I know more about the scriptures? Here's some books that I've found helpful in my time. So Eugene Peterson, Eat This Book. It's a spiritual reading of the text. It's a really helpful book. The one most of you probably won't have heard of, but I think might be the most helpful, is a book called The Insect and the Buffalo. It's a small book. It's written by a guy in New Zealand. You can only get it in the UK on an e-book version. It's quite cheap. But it basically takes you through the whole of the scriptures, telling you the whole story much better than I have done, and you can take as long as you want to do it. But it's really helpful for understanding the fullness of it. How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth is a great book. Many of you will have read. Tom Wright's Scripture and the Authority of God. Why is this authoritative? Why is it that the Bible has authority? A very good book on that. The Blue Parakeet is probably a little more advanced, but it's looking at how do we understand what's in the Scriptures. Quite a helpful book. And then that one in the top left is the Community Bible Experience, New Testament that we're using. I'd encourage you, if some of you want to get together and read the New Testament together, brilliant material, and Martin and Scott can help figure out how to do that as a group. That has been a gallop through something. I think everyone's exhausted, right? Let me pray that God would find something helpful for us in the midst of all of those words. Father, this has been a long morning with much to rejoice over. A team going to South Africa, Connie's wonderful testimony, the opportunity to sing and worship. We have spent the last 40 minutes just thinking on the gift of your scriptures to us, on the practicalities of that. Lord, I have used many words. Just right now, with the stuff that is helpful for us, would you bed that down in our minds? And the stuff that is not that helpful, would you just let it blow away like dust? We want to love you more, Jesus. We thank you. Your scriptures help us with that. Thank you. Your scriptures lead us into truth. Give us a passion to know more of what's in your word, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.